My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm Essie Moadi, founding partner of Mighty Capital, and I'm excited to host this series on the age of product. Let's hear from my guest today.
So welcome, Satya, and why don't we start by having you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Satya Patel. I'm a co-founding partner at Homebrew, which is a seed stage venture capital firm based in San Francisco. Prior to starting Homebrew, I held various roles at operating companies, primarily in product management. Most recently, I was VP of product at Twitter. Before that, I was a partner at another venture capital firm called Battery Ventures. Spent a good part of my career in product management at Google and various other roles before that, but have hopped between investing and in product roles during my career.
Awesome, Satya. And what a great background and how similar to mine. So I want to start with a question about your relationship with a venture capitalist that was really influential to you before starting Homebrew. And not during your time at Battery. So while you were an operator, if there's somebody that comes to mind, and if you could tell us, you know, how you met them, how they were valuable to you, what made them stand out, and then looking back at, you know, your younger self in that role, like what would you tell yourself to build a great relationship with a venture capitalist?
Oh, good questions. So when I was at Twitter, we had a very active board of directors that included a number of very prominent VCs. One of the people I got to know really well was Peter Fenton at Benchmark. The thing that really stood out about Peter for me was how he could ask just a few really pointed questions that would both shape the conversation and quickly get to the heart of the matter at hand. He didn't state specific opinions very often, but he solicited answers to questions that led naturally to a particular point of view for the group to come to. It was a very nuanced way of having influence. And so that really stood out about him when I think about the work that he did. And he spent a lot of time with me and the product organization and thinking through a lot of the higher level challenges we were facing as we thought about things like the platform, balancing growth versus revenue, those types of things. And so really valued that relationship and saw the power of being able to ask the right questions as an investor.
That's awesome. So he obviously added value with his questions. If you go back to your younger years, what would you do to establish a close relationship with him? What advice do you have for someone who's in their product career?
When I was an investor, when I was an operator and I was building relationships with investors, I wish I'd known some of the things that I know now, which comes from having both been an operator and an investor. There's probably two or three things I would say that are critical to building a good relationship with investors. The first and foremost, and it's one that we really emphasize with the founders we work with today, is that there should never be surprises. Good news is acceptable, bad news is acceptable, but no one likes being surprised, and investors like being surprised the least. So I think it's really important to have trust and transparency in the relationship and for there not to be any surprises. The second thing I would say is have the courage of your convictions. Investors are smart people and deep thinkers, but they don't know your business as well as you do. So it's okay to disagree with them. Just know that you're going to be held accountable for your decisions. But sometimes you just have to have the courage of your convictions and not necessarily follow the lead of the investors. And then the third thing is, I wish I would have, and I encourage founders even today, is to ask for more from their investors. Good investors are there to help. I think most founders don't leverage their investors as much as they can, especially in the context of key areas like hiring and sales and fundraising. So those are some of the things that I'd say operators can do to build good relationships with investors.
That's great advice. What's a great way to ask for it? I found that very often people just don't know how to ask.
Yeah, I think one of the best ways of asking is actually being disciplined around it. So I've found that it's really helpful to have set times that you're getting together with investors and to have an agenda in advance. And part of that agenda are the asks that you have. So I think if you're systematic and kind of forcing yourself to have that conversation, you end up forcing yourself to ask for more and get the assistance that you need. So I think it's just the discipline, whether it's in a formal conversation or a monthly email or whatever it might be. But I think if you know you're going to be spending time with an investor, then it kind of forces you to come up with ways to leverage them. Otherwise, you're kind of in a reporting relationship, and that's not that productive for both the founders and the investors.
Right, the prepared mind. I found that investors tend to be so busy that it helps for them to get that agenda or the very specific questions, because it facilitates the context switching.
Absolutely, yeah. And then as a follow-up to the asks is, how do you make fulfillment of the ask as easy as possible, right? Is it a forwardable email? Is it, scheduling separate time for a conversation in more depth? Whatever it takes to kind of make it easier and save them time and energy usually yields the best results.
That's awesome. I want to switch to what you do today at Homebrew. So you transitioned from product into venture, and we'd love to learn about this transition, transferable skills, challenges you had to overcome, how you went about it. And then because you were venture capitalist before and after your time in product, how has your time in product changed the way you build conviction as an investor?
Oh, geez, where to start? Let's see. In terms of kind of the skills that I took from the operating side, there are a few things that I think have been enormously useful in the context of being an investor. The first, not surprisingly, is evaluating talent, right? On the operating side, I had to build teams and manage people. And similar to evaluating founders, you're asking questions like, why does this person want to work here? What's their superpower? Can they rally others to the cause? Are they insatiably curious? Trying to evaluate their attitude as much as their aptitude. And those are all things that were important when building my team or the organization. And we asked almost the exact same questions when evaluating founders in the context of investing. So that's first and foremost, was evaluating talent. The second thing, obviously, like every company has to determine priorities. And so we say now as investors that no startup ever failed from a lack of ambition, only a lack of focus. And so one of the toughest jobs a startup founder has is prioritizing. And similarly, one of the toughest jobs I had as a product management leader was prioritizing the roadmap and keeping the team focused on only the most important things. And so that determining of priorities is super useful as an investor, because that's an important conversation that we need to have with founders on a regular basis. And then the last thing is just coaching and development, right? As a manager, our job was to help our team members be their best selves and remove roadblocks to their success. And we try to do the same as investors working with founders, right? We want them to be them best selves, be their best selves, be as successful as they can be. And our goal in, helping them is to remove roadblocks, whether that's customer introductions or coaching them or helping them hire talent or whatever it might be. At the end of the day, we're just trying to remove obstacles.
That's awesome. That's really helpful. So that's sort of the skills you took with you from your time as an operator. What are some of the challenges that you faced during that transition, and how did you go about overcoming them?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge is probably one you hear about a lot from investors, which is you go from a world in which you can build things, release them, collect data, and iterate to one where the feedback cycles are just so long. And you don't see the immediate impact of your work. You don't know where to improve or how to iterate. And that is really challenging. And I think the way that, Hunter, my partner, and I overcame that was having really clear conviction around our strategy and knowing that if, or believing that if we executed our strategy over the long term, things would work out. And you know, 9 years in, we feel pretty good that things have gone as we would have hoped. But there are definitely times along the way where we had to question what we saw going on, either more broadly or in the context of the work we were doing very specifically, and you know, just continue to have faith, which oftentimes can be really challenging. So that's the biggest challenge. The second one I would argue is going from a world in which you have cross-functional collaboration, where you're working with a team of experts, to a business where it can feel like you're working on your own. And the way we overcame that was just building a partnership that is based first and foremost on trust, right? And where every investment is a homebrew investment collectively, not Sasha's investment or Hunter's investment. And so we try to, you know, gang tackle everything that we do as a team here to kind of replicate that experience of working collaboratively and in teams. But that's also a big transition for a lot of folks as they move from the operating side to the investing side.
Great. Yeah, I mean, a lot of investors say this is a lone job. I'm totally with you on our culture as well at Mighty Capital, that we think of investing as a team game. There are so many different aspects to a deal and making a founder successful. It takes a village. And then I want to react to something you said about the long cycles in investing. You said we have to be really feeling very strongly about our conviction. We have to have faith, which are very soft words. And investing, you know, the outcome being sort of on the opposite end of that, very, very binary. How do you reconcile that? Or maybe the question is, how do you build conviction and base it on data and outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, you can look at interim data like, you know, follow-on financings and the rest, but our view is, you know, nothing is a result until it's cash. And so the only other data that we turn to is kind of our founder NPS, right? And we actually go and do founder surveys to get feedback on what we're doing well, what we're not doing well. And that data is the data that we can look at in a relatively short time frame or a medium time frame. But ultimately, over the very long term, that pairs with financial results. So it is soft to think about having the courage of your convictions and sticking to your strategy, but it requires real discipline. And it's easy to get distracted by things you see happening in the market or companies that you believe are hot or, you know, deals that are moving fast or whatever it may be. So while the words are soft, the discipline is hard.
That makes sense. Super, Satya. This is awesome. I'm really enjoying this. I want to move to now looking at trends, and we're coming out of this pandemic. We've seen that, you know, 2020 has been and 2021 most likely, they both have been or are being dog years. In other words, 7 years of digital transformation crammed into one or two. And what we're seeing with that is we're in an era where the best product wins. And I know you and I will have a great discussion on this, but when I see Zoom beating Google Meet, Amplitude beating Google Analytics, and they're not the only ones, right? Atlassian and many others are companies that have really been built on the assumption that the best product wins. I wonder how you think about that, where you see, whether it's an industry, a particular business model or something else, where you see the best product win?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually think it's pretty rare for the best product to win. I think it's the best distribution that generally wins. I think it's the best product that wins when it's the best product for a specific use case. Or in other words, when there's like exceedingly strong product market fit. Because I could argue that actually Google Meet is a superior product to Zoom. I could argue both sides. I don't think it's that clear, but I do think that for particular use cases, Zoom is a better product. And for others, Google Meet's a better product. And similarly, for Amplitude's a much better product for specific use cases, but Google Analytics is superior for others. So I think the best product can win when it addresses a particular use case, you know, 10x better than everything else that's out there. I also think that the best product generally can win when it becomes a habit, right? Like changing behavior is really hard. So if there's a really great product and it's creating a new habit or enabling something entirely new, like as an example, like the iPhone, right? That's an example of the best product, but it was also paired with the fact that it was enabling something entirely new. And those are situations in which I think the best product wins. But I think there's lots of reasons why the best product doesn't win, including, you know, market timing, pricing, switching costs, marketing, all those kinds of things. So more often than not, I would argue it's the best distribution that wins. You can have a good enough product that gets distribution, and then over time it becomes the best, almost by definition, because it's being used by the most people. And that's an example. I think that probably fits a little bit with Zoom as an example.
Right. So in the majority of cases, you need a sales team, you need effective marketing. But in cases where there's an innovator's dilemma, like what you described with Nokia and Apple, or even, you know, back then I remember when Siebel System was completely disrupted by Salesforce, when there's a clear disruption like this, then the best product wins because it meets a very specific customer need, because it becomes a habit. I love that idea. And it makes us better people, better professional, because it becomes part of our lives.
Yeah, that's a great way of articulating it. Salesforce versus Siebel is interesting. I would argue Salesforce won because it enabled an entirely new set of customers to be able to use a CRM system, right? Siebel Systems was for massive companies that had to spend millions of dollars implementing Siebel, millions more customizing it and maintaining it. And Salesforce being cloud-based kind of enabled an entirely new set of customers to leverage the benefits of a CRM. And it had a different distribution model. And that's why it became the dominant player that it is today.
That's awesome. Yeah. So look for outliers when you're looking to really disrupt a big industry. And in a case like that, then the best product can be actually a winner. I love it. So now forget about this age of product. Look at maybe 5-10 years down the road. What are some of your predictions? And you can pick any area of focus. I know your firm focuses on many different areas. We'd love to hear what you see over the horizon.
Oh, just generic predictions? Let's see. I mean, I do think that we're going to continue to see in venture capital the barbelling of the asset class, so to speak. I think the big firms are going to continue to get larger. And you're going to see many, many more small firms and investors emerge. And that's going to lead to a bunch of firms in the middle of the market, so to speak, having to make some hard decisions about whether they can get bigger or whether they want to make the tough call that firms rarely do of getting smaller. But I think the middle of the market is going to be no man's land. And that's already playing out, but I argue it's going to play out fully over the next 5 to 10 years. The second thing, prediction-wise, I'd say is that the financial services market is a fascinating one where we do a lot of work. And I think you're going to see that financial services are truly going to be cross-border in the next 5 to 10 years. Right now, financial services usually live within a country or geography because of regulatory frameworks. But I think you're going to see either systems that live outside of those regulatory frameworks, or you're going to see the regulatory frameworks change to reflect the fact that we are a global market in a way that we have been for a while, but which has really accelerated over the last decade or so. And then the last prediction that I'll talk about is I do think that outside of the top, call it 50 universities, the university system, the college system is going to largely disappear. I think that the number of opportunities for people to get quote unquote educated, whether it's through online programs or boot camps or new academies, are going to offer much more compelling ROI for people who want to learn specific skills than what the traditional university system has enabled. Again, outside of probably the top 50 universities. So you're going to see huge swaths of the population elect to go follow alternative educational paths.
Super interesting. I'd love to riff a little bit on that. You know, those are really three awesome trends. Venture capital industry, when you say, you know, the barbell continues, right? An empty middle, that tells me it's ripe for disruption. And, you know, back to our conversation about great products, like how would you imagine disruption coming into the VC industry?
Well, I think you're seeing it now with the innovation that has started with things like rolling funds, you know, SPVs, founder or operator investors. Like those are all disruptions that are reacting to the fact that founders want certain type of investors. And then on the flip side, you're seeing the big platforms build out their services arms and their marketing capabilities and investing full stack, again, in reflection of what's going on in the market from a competitive standpoint and based on what founders demand. And so that disruption is already happening, right? If you would have said a decade and a half ago, you know, what does the venture industry look like? And it would have been, you know, the 100 or so firms on Sand Hill Road that dominated the market. And as you know, only a handful of firms generated all the returns. And you're already seeing that those returns are getting distributed across a larger number of firms. And you're also seeing that capital is available in many more and from many more places than it was, you know, even 15 years ago. So that disruption is happening. And I think it's going to only accelerate by virtue of the fact that entrepreneurship is everywhere. And now capital is following where entrepreneurship is.
Really interesting. Yeah, it's basically like the long tail with all these different models that will fit almost lots of different types of entrepreneurship. I love that. And then, so your second trend was in the globalization of financial services. I love hearing that. We have a focus on financial services as well. Our view is that it's a bit of a melting of the ice age in financial services, in many ways powered by the blockchain. Do you think there's going to be a significant role for the blockchain? Is it going to come from blockchain or not? We'd love to hear your take on that.
Yeah, I think you know, DeFi and blockchain are going to have an important role to play in that. Certainly, I don't think they're the only enablers, but and there's some things that have to happen in order for them to really play the role that everyone thinks that they can play. But I think that there's going to be lots of different technologies and business models that are going to help the financial markets become more global and products and services to be available and used more globally. And it's because consumers are going to demand it and businesses are going to demand it. And you're already starting to see that happen.
Great. And then lastly, the education trend that you mentioned, scary in many ways, because for so many of the inequalities we have in the world, right, education is an equalizer. And so no education or just the very top segment and a lot of innovation there is going to have an impact on inequalities in the world. How do you see that shake up? Do you see more professional training? Where do you see education go?
Yeah, I actually think that all the trends we're seeing in education are directly a response to the inequalities in education, right? The fact that it's so expensive to be educated and that for the most part, those educational institutions and the time spent there don't pay off is the exact problem that all this democratization of education is addressing, right? You're going to have educational options that are way more accessible from a price point standpoint, from a delivery standpoint in terms of being virtual versus physical. You're going to have educational options that cater to very specific educational needs or educational topics in a way that the current university system can't accommodate. So I think it's going to actually open up opportunity for all kinds of people to get educated in a way that they can't and to get educated in a way that sets them up for long-term economic success.
Awesome. Hey, Satya, I have three more questions for you before we wrap up, and we're going to do them lightning strike style.
All right.
So what makes a great VC investor?
What makes a great VC investor? Curiosity, empathy, and grit.
Awesome. What advice do you have for our audience? Our listeners are VC investors and innovators in general.
Making investments is transactional, but investing is a very long game. So I think it's really important that investors and innovators think of the work they're doing over the very long term in terms of it really being relationship driven, in terms of staying focused on a North Star, and in terms of acting in a way that has a long-term orientation. And so sometimes that means sacrificing short-term greed.
Interesting. Great. And so Satya, you're one of the most successful investors out here in Silicon Valley. What are some of the books, podcasts, blog that inspire you, and how do you stay sharp in general?
Yeah, I try to read and listen to things that are outside of investing and tech for the most part. So lots of fiction, but one of the podcasts that I really enjoy listening to, because I really appreciate kind of greatness in every industry, is a podcast called Song Exploder. Song Exploder is a podcast that has artists go on there and talk about how they came up with a song and the process which led to a song. And I just find it fascinating, inspiring, and I love music to hear artists tell those stories.
That's awesome. What's your favorite song?
Oh, geez. That's a tough one. If I had to pick one, I would pick World Leader Pretend by REM.
All right.
Satya, thank you. That's an important song for me growing up. Yep.
Good to know. Thank you so much. I had a blast recording this this interview with you and really enjoyed the discussion. Anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
No, thanks for having me on. I hope it was useful for the folks who are listening, and really appreciate you having more folks like me come and educate the folks via Kaufman Fellows.
Awesome. Thank you, Satya.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.